Welcome to the Defense and Aerospace Report podcast. I'm your host, Vago Maradian. Our podcast is brought to you by Bell. Since 1935, Bell has been redefining flight. Learn more about its pioneering spirit at bellflight.com. And joining us now, as they do every week, for our roundtable discussion for the week in Washington and the world are Dr. Gordon Adams, a fellow at the Quincy Institute and the Stimson Center and a professor emeritus at American University. Byron Callen of the independent Washington research firm, Capital Alpha Partners, Mackenzie Eaglin of the American Enterprise Institute, Michael Herson of American Defense International, one of Washington's top defense and aerospace lobbying firms, and former Pentagon Comptroller Dr. Dov Zakheim, who among his many roles is a senior advisor at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. Everybody, welcome back to the program.
Glad to be here, Vago.
Always a pleasure.
Thank you.
Great to be back.
Good to be back, Vago.
And before we get started, our global coverage is sponsored by Leonardo DRS. Northrop Grumman sponsors our weekly cyber report and our cyber coverage overall. Fincantieri Marinette Marine sponsors our naval coverage. General Atomics Aeronautical Systems sponsors our coverage of strategy. And Beretta USA sponsors our land warfare coverage. Michael, very, very busy time up on the Hill, obviously, with the stimulus package that's ongoing. Testimony from Stacey Cummings calling for $11 billion. DOD's acting acquisition chief for $11 billion to cover contracted COVID-related charges. And we have the Tandon nomination that's hit the rock. As well as the January 6th commission that's ongoing. First, give us some breaking news from the Hill and what it means.
Sure. So the breaking news actually dovetails with President Biden's executive order that came out earlier this week that aims to address, you know, supply chain vulnerabilities. You know, it directs federal agencies to undertake a 100-day review of supply chain vulnerabilities for four main product lines: pharmaceutical ingredients and medicines, semiconductors and electronic packaging, battery needs, critical minerals in defense manufacturing. It also directs a one-year review for industrial sectors supplying defense and other critical areas. But even before the executive order came out, Adam Smith's committee was already planning on creating a panel to look at supply chain. And the panel is going to be co-chaired by Alyssa Slotkin and Mike Gallagher. And they're going to have a very broad jurisdiction to look at this. And I think it shows, too, how Smith is really being very aggressive with his committee this year, responding to the challenges that we face by creating that new cyber subcommittee and now creating this panel on supply chain.
And two very bipartisan and thoughtful members, right, in Alyssa Slotkin and Mike Gallagher.
Yes, absolutely. They will work well together, and they really wanted to do this together. So, and I can't say who the other members of the panel are yet, but it's really going to be a really good, strong bipartisan group. And the challenges are huge in supply chain. So I think their challenge is going to be how do they address their jurisdiction in the timeframe that they've got.
The stimulus is obviously moving ahead. House voting on $1.9 trillion. We're taping this on Friday morning. So the expectation is that it is going to pass the House. The question is what happens in the Senate. Give us an update on that.
So the House is going to rules this morning. Now, there's talk of possibly voting on the package tomorrow, but most people believe that they will vote on the package late tonight. So the news really is as not really what's in the package, but what's not in the package. So it's still at $1.9 trillion. However, late yesterday, the Senate parliamentarian ruled that the minimum wage could not be included in the package. But despite that, the House is saying they're still going to keep the minimum wage in their package tonight because they feel it's very important, even though they know it's not going to be in the final version. That is a challenge because a lot of Democrats don't want to vote for a package that they know is not going to be the final package. At the same time, there are some Democrats that say they won't vote for it if the minimum wage is not in there because they feel it's important, even knowing that it's not going to be in the final package. Also, the extensions for DOD on Section 3610 from the CARES Act will not be in the reconciliation package because, again, it does not meet the parliamentary rules. So there's a scramble to figure out what vehicle they can put these authorities in to keep the extension going beyond March for the DOD community.
And what is the appetite? You know, we've talked about this issue. What's the appetite for monies to cover contracted COVID-related charges? I mean, after all, it's legally they're allowed to claim that cost, and it's cost that they had to incur to do business for the department. But we know that members of Congress have been on both sides of this issue. Where are we from where you sit?
Even though we're spending like drunken sailors right now, there is no appetite for that. I mean, look, Ellen Lord asked for similar funds in the last Congress. So I don't anticipate this Congress supporting that request. I think there's a feeling that the defense budget is still very high. The last administration was able to steal upwards of $9 billion for the border wall, plus O&M costs fell during COVID, and that they could find this money internally.
Right. And there's a sense that the contractors have been doing very well and that their costs elsewhere have been lower on it. Very, very quickly, Michael, really quickly, want to get your sense on the January 6th commission, because life is getting a little bit warm for some Republican members of Congress in terms of their links and, you know, husbands and what have you with three percenters and other things, as well as the outlook for Neera Tanden. Before you have an opportunity to tell us, I told you so, you did say that the one nominee that's likely going to hit the buzzsaw is Neera Tanden.
There's been a lot of hearings on the Hill leading up to the formal establishment of this January 6th commission. And some of the testimony has been fascinating. I mean, just the other day, the former Capitol Police chief testified that the senators at the Pentagon, leaders worried about the optics of sending armed troops to the Capitol during a conference call during the day of the attack, even as the police chiefs were emphasizing how the security forces desperately needed backup. And the officers, the acting Capitol Hill police chief said that their officers didn't properly lock down the Capitol complex, and it wasn't clear to them whether they could or could not use lethal force. So, I mean, the failings just keep stacking up. Now, the larger problem is Pelosi is looking at establishing this January 6th commission, but really on a partisan basis. She wants seven Democrats and four Republicans on the panel. And, you know, if they're modeling this after the 9/11 commission, that was really a 50-50 split and nonpartisan. And former members of that commission are warning her and her colleagues that this really should be bipartisan. And frankly, Senator Coons, who's Biden's guy in the Senate, came out saying that this commission should be bipartisan. So in the end, I think there will be a commission. I do think it will be equal 50-50 Democrat and Republican.
And Neera Tanden?
Look, I think she's going down. I think, you know, we all learn that we have to be very careful what we publish and what we say on Twitter. I also think that there are two other nominees that are questionable right now too, and their confirmations also have an implication for national security. I mean, Deb Haaland is still not a shoo-in for Secretary of the Interior, and she is on armed services. So they're holding her slot open on the committee, depending on her confirmation. And Xavier Becerra, for HHS, you know, if he ends up getting confirmed, Adam Schiff has expressed interest in not chairing the Intelligence Committee anymore, but going back to California and being the Attorney General. So a lot of these are still in question.
Byron, let me bring you into the conversation. And obviously, as we get near this $1.9 trillion, markets are responding in kind. Talk to us about the inflation fear, how the market is responding to it, and how you think it could affect the defense debate going forward.
The key has just been the market signaling with the really rapid increase in interest rates. The 10-year, you know, about a month ago was around 1%. Yesterday, it breached 1.5%. That's a pretty sharp move. And, you know, that move happened, you know, on shorter maturities as well. The 5-year had a pretty big jump. I don't think this is so much about the $1.9 trillion as much as it's what's next. And, you know, that's $2, $3 trillion on top to kind of get the economy going. You know, there have been concerns. I mean, these things have popped up, like the semiconductor shortage. You know, you had unemployment claims down a bit this week. So I think what the market may be signaling is it's not to say that people don't need the aid and assistance, that there still aren't businesses, that we shouldn't spend money on infrastructure and these other elements of getting the economy on a firmer footing. But, you know, if you looked at the CBO report from, I think it was February 12th, where they did their last set of projections, their net interest outlay assumptions were based on a 1.3% 10-year rate through 2025. If we breach that and go higher, and again, you know, CBO is based on current law. It doesn't have these incremental spending packages. You're going to see higher interest outlays, and that just adds to the question about, you know, what are the pressures on discretionary spending? You know, where's the money going to come from to pay those higher interest outlays?
before we move on, I just want to get your sense, right? I mean, the president did sign his executive order, but there is a sense that that's on Buy America and moving supply chains to the United States and all. But that's seen as more of something that's optical at this point, right? As opposed to something that's actively going to move a needle. I mean, what's your sense on that?
I mean, look, the main question on all this stuff is it's fine to authorize these things or put executive orders out, but where's the money going to come from? I mean, last year's NDAA had, you know, authorized $10 billion for a domestic semiconductor industry, you know, that would, but where was the related appropriation for that? So these are the kind of things, you know, when we talk about rebuilding or reshoring manufacturing or, you know, kind of decoupling from China, there's going to be a cost associated with these things. It's not to say that it shouldn't be done, but I think the real key is going to be where are the appropriations for those kind of initiatives? And I'd say the same thing with supply chain. You know, when you look at rare earth elements, you know, they're not rare. They're in mill and mining tailings. They're just difficult and costly to get to, and they're very environmentally messy. There's a pretty big price tag associated with actually getting the U.S. off of reliance from China on some of these critical rare earth elements. So there's a bill for all this. It's not to say it shouldn't be done. It really probably should be done. But, you know, the price tag is still going to be a hurdle.
For folks who are interested, we talked to Jim Litinsky, the chairman and CEO and the founder of MP Materials, the nation's only rare earths facility that he's standing up in California and meets stringent California environmental regulations. So I commend everybody to listen to that conversation. And the big challenge is, right, that China has an entire ecosystem. So it's not just the materials, it's the fact that China dominates motors, whether they're for electric cars or motors for power or any other capacity, and that they've created that entire ecosystem that's as useful for iPhones as it is for a green transportation or advanced weaponry, right? I mean, and I think that most Americans don't recognize that the components that go into some of our most sensitive weapons, those neodymium magnets, originate from China. So the establishment of that ecosystem in the United States is something that will also face pushback from established companies that want to get this sort of subsidized Chinese capability for a lot less money than perhaps creating that ecosystem in the United States. Gordon, you know and are an alumni from OMB. You were the national security director there during the Clinton administration, and somebody who's both taught and practiced national security budgeting. What happens if Neera Tanden, as we now expect, doesn't make it? Who's the person who's queued up to go in there? Where does Neera Tanden go, given the administration has said that they will preserve her? And most importantly, what's the budget guidance that's going out to government departments? Because now we're sort of in passback territory, right? Where the new administration is trying to figure all of this out on the fly to get a budget publicly released soon in macro terms, and then give the details in April.
Right, and it's been very busy at the Office of Management and Budget, and very quiet because that's the way the Office of Management and Budget works. The Neera Tanden, interestingly, the Neera Tanden nomination has been obviously a sore spot in trouble for the White House, but it has not stepped in the way of the process at OMB or the process in the Oval Office. And that has meant that this planning on the budgetary terms has been rolling along with the expectation that there will be a very skinny document sometime in March, maybe two pages per agency, that is going to describe very top line terms what each agency is going to look for in terms of budgeting. The process, as I've been saying for a while, is very quick and very top down. Most of the major decisions here are being made in the Oval Office. The process is largely being driven by Brian Deese, who's the head of the National Economic Council and much experienced practitioner in budgetary arts, and inside OMB by Aviva Arendine, who is a non-confirmation position of executive associate director. So while we've been waiting for a director and a deputy director, this process has been moving along. In terms of Neera Tanden, it's pretty clear that this, as Michael is saying, her nomination is probably going down. Where they're going to locate her in the executive branch, I don't know, but they clearly will. She's very close to Hillary Clinton. My guess is this was in some ways an appointment very influenced by Hillary Clinton. They will find a place for her somewhere in the executive branch that's non-confirmation related. What's coming out of the OMB process, it has been moving very, very smoothly. Inside OMB, they have been holding director reviews at a very top line level for each federal agency. Brian's been involved in those. The Domestic Policy Council has been involved. The Council of Economic Advisors has been involved. And in the end, decisions have been made. And the decisions that get made here, let me repeat, are being made in the Oval Office. They're not being made at OMB. They're not being made by Aviva Arendine. They are being done in the Oval Office, very much involving Biden. And the numbers are basically set. When pushed, OMB is not particularly prepared to say what those numbers are for defense or for anything else. But it looks like they will be doing pass back, I'm betting maybe even as early as next week, back to the agencies, because they have to then respond and come back to the White House with any appeals or problems that they have with the pass back. So that document in the middle of the March can be prepared, and looking forward to producing a bigger document, full budget request, early May, in all likelihood. The paperwork that's now being reported by Paul McCleary and others about what's going on in the Pentagon makes it clear that the Pentagon has assumed it has some kind of guidance here, and they are looking to five or six key areas that Kathix has outlined that they want to do planning on. I will point out that's not a surprising process. Once again, transition year, new administration, fast budget process, no people in the policy positions. You go to five or six items. It's exactly what Les Aspin did in 1993 when we prepared a very fast budget at the OMB level. What's the likely level of guidance? What I'm hearing, no surprise to anybody on this call, certainly no surprise to me. Asked if this was somewhere between flat with inflation and flat without inflation, the answer seems to be, yeah, that's about the right ballpark. So things that we have all been saying on this broadcast seem to be coming to fruition in the way passback is going to be handed back to the department. So business as usual, absence of a director, Neera Tanden or somebody else, still going on. And in terms of her succession, there are three or four people named. Jean Sperling is the name that everybody is most likely to know. I don't think it's going to be Jean. Could be. Who knows? But the inside betting is that Shalanda Young, who has been nominated to be the deputy, will simply move up into the full slot. That is, in many respects, from OMB's and budget perspective, very good news. She's highly qualified, 14 years Appropriations Committee staff in the House. Everybody on the Hill knows her. I expect, in contrast to Neera Tanden, this is not a tweeter. Her nomination, if put forward sometime soon, will go through.
I want to just sort of frame for people how bizarre this is. If you have a problem with Neera Tanden, then have a problem with Neera Tanden. But I really find it astonishing that there's a concern about tweets and really mild ones at that, in comparison with what some even members of Congress had said and what the former president used to say on a fairly regular basis.
So smacks a little bit of hypocrisy.
A little bit. Just a
welcome
little
to politics.
Just a little bit. Mackenzie, want to get your thoughts on any of that, but especially your very thoughtful conversation with Siku Brown, the U.S. Air Force chief. Obviously, the Aerospace Warfare Symposium started the day after your conversation with the chief, and that event is still ongoing as we have this conversation. From your standpoint, what were the key takeaways, right? He was a little bit more low-key than the big news he made the week before when talking about the need for a fifth generation minus, which got a lot of people speculating about the future of the F-35 program, which is, right, the replacement for the F-16. And effectively what the chief was saying is, we need a new replacement for the F-16, which people found interesting.
Heads were exploding. Right. So he certainly did make a lot of news. And then he's continued to talk about the tactical aircraft study across the services that's being undertaken in the department. So it's not just an Air Force study, which is interesting. Right. So, you know, he's opening up the aperture for the possibility of there being four plus, you know, fighter programs for the Air Force underway at one time, which is pretty remarkable if you think about it, at least in modern times. You know, but he really was batting cleanup about his comments on the F-35 in particular, which led to a story by David Axe that broke Twitter for the F-35 when it was trending, which is an unusual, I would argue, for just normal people to think about Air Force fighter jets to the extent that they did. The chief has since sort of walked back his comments, saying, you know, that the F-35 is a cornerstone of the service going forward. But we all know that the cost per flying hour has been a complaint by Air Force leadership for some time now. And, you know, a couple of years ago, the CAPE directed study led to what is now, you know, the production of the Boeing F-15EX. And part of the thinking behind that was to force some price competition on the F-35, even though they're two different capabilities in to a large extent. And, you know, the buy rate. And then the chief talked about not just, you know, in his cleanup that it's the cornerstone, but he also talked about that maybe we need to surge production. So going in a totally different direction, saying essentially, you know, we might have to buy out more than what we said we would originally, because the service has been buying anywhere from 50 to 60 a year, depending on what Congress pluses up. But the plan all along had been, you know, over 100. So that's interesting. You know, and to the one-on-one that the chief and I had at AFA, he was low-key. I think, you know, your assessment earlier, Vago, that he was careful not to make any news is exactly right. He was really focused on airmen and their families for the majority of his remarks. But, you know, we did talk about his work with the other chiefs, particularly the Commandant of the Marine Corps, to, you know, he's a man in a hurry, right? There's no question about it. He's trying to do big things. He's trying to change his own services culture. That's really, really hard to do. He's trying to convince stakeholders in OSD and Congress to think differently about readiness, which is something that they haven't been inclined to do. He's trying to even reduce the demand signal from combatant commanders. I'd argue that is a windmill very hard to tilt at, as we saw this week with the strike in Syria. And more on that later with Secretary Austin's comments. But all in all, he's making progress, I guess, on his accelerate, change, or lose vision. And basically, he said if he's making progress, that's a good grade.
I want to get your sense on whether his comments on F-35, right? I mean, you did suggest that that was part of the whole leverage. There is a little bit of frustration, especially with the cost per flying hour. And we saw that there was a support contract that was struck after this. Do you get a sense that some of his comments and it were specifically aimed at putting a lot sharper pressure on Lockheed at the end of the day? Or is this the genuine start of the weakening of support for the F-35 that we spent 30 years developing an airplane that the original requirement goes back to the Fulda Gap, and it's time for us to maybe do something else?
I really do think it's both. His comments before he started, you know, cleaning up were pretty significant for any Air Force chief, how direct that he was. You know, the rumor inside the building is that, you know, the Air Force is looking at its total buy, and it could drop to as low as just over 1,000 as opposed to over 1,700. It's still a rumor, but it wouldn't be shocking, right? Because if the Air Force, the modernization bow wave crunch is here, both for conventional and strategic forces. No service knows that better than the Air Force, with two legs of the triad and all these fighters to recapitalize. There just isn't enough money. And if they go that route, you know, it could wind up being acceptable to Congress, because you wouldn't disrupt production immediately, right? It's something that would be sort of an out years process, and you have time to get Congress on board. I think it's both.
It's interesting, because if you went back even 20 years ago, there were some in the U.S. Air Force, even 20 years ago, who were saying, we're never likely to get to 1763. That's just a planning number. We think it'll probably be about 1200, but it's a decision we don't have to make now, right? So it's kind of interesting that eventually you get to the point where you have to make that decision now.
I would just say it's remarkable it hasn't been revisited, the total JSF buy across the services. I've never seen a program go this long with being revalidated at the original buy level. Frankly, that itself has been a miracle, and it can't last.
It's also been part of the marketing campaign on the program, right? I mean, we want to make sure that it's big and it's robust and allies and partners who are, you know, for many of the nations, this is their biggest defense program in history, right? So at the end of the day, there's a lot riding on it. Dov, you've been very, very patient, but I want to jump very quickly to Michael. Michael, and without compromising, I know that you represent a lot of the companies that are involved in the F-35 program. I should point out, right, MP Materials is also one of your clients. At the end of the day, do you notice a change in support for the F-35 program and how people are talking about it, both in public and in private, right? I mean, these sorts of things start slow, but they have a tendency of snowballing, especially when people in the Biden team make clear we are going to make the tough decisions that have been avoided because we have no more time. I've been writing about this for years. It's good to hear that. The problem is, like, people end up getting hurt, right, when you actually execute it. And there appears to be some seriousness with how they're pursuing this. Are you hearing more future of the F-35 conversations on the Hill?
Again, as you pointed out, I represent a lot of people that make almost every part of this aircraft, except for the prime contractor. So I got to be careful, but not yet. And also I think there's a feeling that there's really no current alternative, but, you know, I think there's a lot of wait and see. Let's see what the budget request says. And let's see, as the hearing process takes place. But my indication is the F-35 has tremendous support on Capitol Hill.
Dov, give us your sense on what you've heard and any other new ground you want to till as we try to make sense of what has been a busy week. And then we've still got to get to the airstrike and what portends next. So you get a double bite of the apple at the end of the program.
Well, thank you. First, the one thing that struck me was that President Biden never really was as enthusiastic about $15 minimum wage as some other people were. So I think he was bailed out by the Senate parliamentarian. And that's no small thing, because I think it helps the rest of the package move along. So that struck me this week. Another thing that happened recently that people may not have focused on was we sent another destroyer through the Taiwan Strait. We were also operating in the South China Sea, and the Chinese responded with at least 10 bombers in a strike exercise in the South China Sea. So the pushing and shoving continues, and I think that ties in very much with what we just happened in the Middle East, because the strike tells me that yet again, every new administration says they're getting out of the Middle East and then they get sucked in again. And remember, Trump did pretty much the same thing at pretty much the same time. And of course, they never got out of the Middle East. So that's something to watch, because at the very same time this is all going on, Kath Hicks, the deputy secretary, has launched yet a new quick review of some of the legacy programs. And obviously, it's with a view to seeing what can be got rid of. Well, if you're going to have this kind of tension with China, you're going to have tension with Russia, and you're still firing missiles in the Middle East, there's going to be a lot of pushback as to what should be gotten rid of, despite all the great stuff about unmanned and so on. So in a way, all of this does kind of tie together, and not necessarily in an easy way because of all what we've talked about in terms of the budget. I was predicting inflation would go up. I also happen to be an economist, and I know that economists never agree with each other. But if inflation goes up, that's just that much more pressure on a defense budget that already many people say is pressed for more resources. And one other thing about the F-35, I have a piece, my piece in the Hill this morning talks about the new Anglo-Japanese arrangement. And one of the things that the Brits and the Japanese have said, it's the first time in over 100 years that they had anything coming close to a treaty, is that they would work together on the F-35. And so you have this contrast between allies that are expecting to get the F-35, even though they're paying through the nose for it, and the kind of pressure on the program that you've just heard about.
Well, I mean, as a longtime supporter of the F-35, I do think that former Deputy Defense Secretary Gordon England had it right a long time ago. The two versions of the jet that should have survived was the carrier-capable Charlie, which has a greater payload capability, which then folks on land bases could use as well, and the F-35 Bravo, which is really, in some respects, the most game-changing capability, particularly if you're using it in an Asia scenario where conventional runways will be struck and carriers may be vulnerable. You may be able to distribute your air power in a way that's much, much more novel with a short takeoff and vertical landing aircraft, and one that actually is remarkably comparable. There's a tendency of thinking of it as a latter-day AV-8B Harrier, and it has the range of an F-18 with the short takeoff and vertical landing capability. And if you operate it from a medium-long airfield, you can actually carry an enormous amount of payload on the jet as well.
And it's worth noting that the Air Force also just had an exercise where they essentially island hopped. And so if you combine the island hopping, which essentially meant that they didn't stay in one place for more than an hour, which would make it much more difficult for the Chinese to target, you combine that with the kinds of capabilities you were just talking about, it gives the Chinese pause, I think.
It does, but range is what's important, and we have to figure out how to do that part of the equation.
And that's where the island hopping comes in, because exactly what they were doing.
It can, but then again, we don't really have the logistics and support mindset to be able to do distributed basing like this, right? I mean, so that's the other challenge. I want to get to that in a separate program. We've got about a couple of minutes left. Dov, you're going to get two bites of this apple. Time is running short, but I want to get your sense on this, and Gordon and anybody else, as we wrap up the program. All eyes were on how the Biden administration was going to respond to rocket attacks on U.S. bases from Iranian-backed militias in Iraq. We saw that response. The administration struck an Iranian-backed militia base just on the other side of the border in Syria. Obviously, there was coordination with the Iraqi leadership, so this wasn't a Qasem Soleimani discussion. And the president also had a conversation with Mohammed bin Salman, and all eyes are on what happens to the recalibration of the relationship between Washington and Riyadh after Washington releases the report, the intelligence report, or the cleaned up version or the public version of the intelligence report on the Jamal Khashoggi assassination. Talk to us about those both, whether the administration has sent the right message, on the one hand, ready to negotiate, on the other hand, ready to punish, and what the Khashoggi matter is likely to hold for the future of what is a strategically important relationship at a time when China is trying to curry a lot of favor with Saudi Arabia.
Well, in terms of the strike, clearly what they're trying to do is something along the lines that the Israelis have been doing for years inside Syria, which is going after the Iranians, but not directly. This allows them to continue to pushed for some kind of talks with the Iranians on the nuclear issue, although the Iranians haven't indicated they want to do that anyway, but it allows the administration to really calibrate its response. As I said a moment ago, it does seem to indicate that once again, we may be stuck in the Middle East a little more than we think. And that really goes also to the discussion with Mohammed bin Salman. Again, it's a matter of calibration. On the one hand, Biden seems to have made it clear that this kind of behavior just is intolerable. But on the other hand, we need the Saudis for the reasons that we've always needed the Saudis, which is we want stability in the region. We actually need their bases. We've made it an arrangement with them so that we could operate out of their facilities in the West. Makes it a little bit harder for the Iranians to get to our Air Force. Clearly, we need the Saudis still. They're still the most powerful country in the peninsula. And so it's a matter of calibration. I think in terms of Saudi Arabia, they've handled it quite well. In terms of Iran, we'll just have to wait and see. As I say, the Israelis have managed to bomb the heck out of the Iranians inside Syria without getting into the big confrontation that nobody wants. So they may be handling that one too, but we have to wait and see how the Iranians respond. And the Iranians have ways of responding. They just blew up an Israeli flagged ship that was in the Gulf of Oman, they have their ways of retaliation. This, they're not just going to sit tight, and we have to wait and see what happens.
Gordon, you get the last word, and please flag for our audience the report on statecraft you just produced. You've been giving us teasers and tasters on this. Bring us home.
Happy to. It's interesting, just keying off of the discussion we had earlier about the COVID supplemental, the manager's amendment to the COVID supplemental that came out this week included $10 billion, believe it or not, for the State Department and USAID for international COVID response. These are not contributions to the international COVAX. It's the operational expending and programs of the USAID and the State Department. So while the Defense Department has been sort of kept out of the COVID relief package, interestingly enough, the State Department and USAID have been included in it with money I'm sure they'll want to continue in their baseline in the future. That's relevant to the report that just came out. I did a report on fixing America's civilian statecraft for the Quincy Institute. It appeared yesterday. It is available on the Quincy Institute website, and there's a summary at Responsible Statecraft, which is the journal, the blog, if you will, of the Quincy Institute. And basically, it says that if Joe Biden wants to put diplomacy first and in the lead, which he said repeatedly, simply adding money and diplomats to the State Department is not going to fix it. That the State Department and the civilian international toolkit has a lot of basic challenges. And three of them I just underlined in a report, and I'll just give them a few couple of words each. One, State Department has no strategic planning capability, never has had, needs one badly. It needs the capacity to do the kind of strategic planning and consulting services that the Defense Department has if it's going to organize itself around a greater concept of strategy so it can engage in the interagency with the Defense Department, which brings a lot of strategic tools to the table. So it has heft back in that universe of the interagency where we're trying to demilitarize U.S. foreign policy. Two, they need a budget planning process that's coherent, something again that the Pentagon has largely through the PPBES system, but a centralized comptroller-like establishment in the State Department that allows them to link strategy and resources and above all make a coherent case to OMB and to the Hill about the wisdom behind their budget request. And thirdly, we need to hire different kinds of folks. As diplomats, we need to train them through their careers and not just at the beginning. We need to add to their knowledge base in strategic planning, in budgeting, in program management, administration, and oversight. So we really have ambassadors and diplomats who know how programs operate. And we need them to have the ability to be cross-assigned within the State Department over to the Defense Department at Homeland Security or the Justice Department and to be rewarded for doing that in the promotion chain, incentivized to do that inside the promotion chain for foreign service officers reaching the senior foreign service. So I urge people to take a look at it if they're interested in how to strengthen civilian diplomacy and step towards what Bob Gates wanted to achieve, which is a stronger civilian capacity vis-a-vis DOD in the definition of American national security policy.
Thanks very much, Gordon. Byron and Mackenzie, it's been a while since we've talked to both of you. Any last thoughts and things that you've got on your mind as we close out the week?
I would just add, Vago, on the F-35, as much as I'm a little skeptical that this was just a tactic to, weigh on Lockheed and bring down operating costs. But I think the other kind of maybe one of the other unanticipated or unappreciated impacts is how this affects some of the international sales campaigns that are ongoing for the F-35. It isn't a competition in Finland, Switzerland, and Canada. And, I think the more there are kind of these conflicting signals about what is the U.S. going to do about its tactical aircraft mix, that will weigh on the F-35's competitiveness. And maybe back to the point that Dove made on the BAE, the Anglo-Japanese cooperation. That's an RF system. And it is intriguing because that's something that, in effect kind of gets lifted out of RTAR compliance. And it could bear on both, not just the F-35, but also the Japanese aircraft and the Tempest program in the UK. So it's fascinating to see, you know, kind of this internationalization that's been ongoing for the defense sector, but, you know, may have some different impacts on the exportability of U.S. products, too.
And at the end of the day, right, the British have been looking for the Japanese as a risk-sharing partner on Tempest, both on technology and getting that capability in to another ally, and another ally that's looking at defending its own sovereign sort of aircraft capability, right? I mean, that's the big concern about F-35 is, however good it is, we're buying an American product at the end of the day, as opposed to advancing our own industry, which is one of the reasons why Italy is such a key Tempest partner at the end of the day.
Yeah, I mean, and I talked to someone, you know, day before yesterday about how the British were just blindsided by this whole eruption on the F-35, and they were not happy.
I can't imagine anybody was happy. And on the podcast, that's one of the on the business podcast is something that we discussed. Sash Tusa of Agency Partners in London, his big concern was, or his big observation was, you know, you guys really have managed to undermine this program at a time when all the fourth plus generation fighter makers are out on the market saying, hey, you know, you may not need fifth generation. And you hear from the chief of staff of the United States Air Force, well, fifth generation minus is an airplane we'll need. I understand the context. He's saying, I already have fifth generation and I need a little bit more, maybe fifth generation minus airplanes. But still, to your point, undermines it. Mackenzie, any last thoughts?
Just quickly about the back to the chief, but not the F-35. You know, he teased the idea of this new force employment model for the Air Force. He wouldn't really get into any detail, but he's clearly got a new model in mind. It, you know, he flew this week with a couple of congressional delegations. He was able to get in the cockpit again, which made him real happy. There was a hot pit in a KC-135, and what they found was this idea came from airmen, and it cut refueling time on the ground by 75%. And of course, as Dove was saying, you know, they no permanent bases. You can't bring anybody with you. The Air Force has to adapt. And they proved this week that they're trying to think about that.
And we should point out, right, he was Pacific Air Force's chief, where the agile combat employment was something that he was working very, very hard in terms of being able to do more distributed operations across the Pacific as both an offensive capability, but also as a defensive component. Dove, we've got 10 seconds. We've been talking about the F-35. Any update on F-35s to the United Arab Emirates, which is something that the Biden administration was squeezing the brakes on after the Trump administration was going full speed ahead? Very briefly, what's the status on that?
Still hanging, but I think that everything we've just talked about, the pressures on the program, I think will increase the pressure on the administration to let this sale go through. I mean, there may be other sales that were hoped for and now may not materialize. And even the British, as you said, there are issues there. And Parliament's been challenging the costs of F-35 for years without getting a straight answer.
Everybody, thanks so very much for joining us. Really appreciate it. Hope everybody has a great weekend and a great week, and looking forward to having you all back on again next week. Thanks very much.
Thanks, Vago.
Thank you.
Thanks, Vago.
Thanks, Vago.
Thanks, Vago.
And now a word from our sponsor, retired United States Army Major General Jeff Schlosser, who is the Executive Vice President for Strategic Pursuits at Bell.
We've been building creative and innovative aircraft, next generation types of capabilities for almost 9 decades. Bell is the company that can deliver that.
Thanks very much, sir. And thanks to all of you for listening. Please follow our daily podcasts and visit the Defense and Aerospace Report website to subscribe to our weekly newsletter. Follow us on Twitter, like us on Facebook at Defense and Aerospace Report, and check us out on LinkedIn. And stay tuned for our weekly cyber report sponsored by Northrop Grumman. Thanks again to Bell for their generous sponsorship, and we'll see you again tomorrow.